all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. In his book, Guardian Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror, Thomas Pecora writes, "People living in the United States enjoy a level of safety almost incomprehensible for most people on the planet. In the U.S., most people simply don't realize what has to happen in the background so that they can sedately drive to work, take their kids to school, and go out for dinner with hardly a thought for their safety. There has to be someone on the wall 24/7. This isn't how the rest of the world operates. In fact, I've spent an enormous amount of time in countries with police who are as dangerous as the criminals they're supposed to be working against. Public security apparatuses are often underfunded, undertrained, and barely able to respond adequately to a hard rainstorm." Sobering, and a message we all need to hear often. Thomas Pecora has 27 years experience in the security field, 25 of those working in the Central Intelligence Agency. As a member of the CIA's Protective Operations Cadre, he spent time in hotbeds all around the globe and along the way received the Intelligence Star, the CIA's second highest honor for valor. Now, despite the fact that I saw an inordinately large number of seemingly out-of-place plumber service trucks, cable installers, and SUVs with heavily tinted windows around the radio station when I arrived today, we are very pleased to have Mr. Pecora join us on American Warrior Radio. Thomas, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you, Ben, for having me on your show.
Well, I'm going to try and keep it legal, Thomas. And I'd like to start with that. Well, explain the process. When I was first contacted by your publisher, I thought, hey, cool, CIA guy, book. Oh, wait. Well, I mean, you can't just go out and start putting pen to paper, right? I mean, how long did you to actually produce this work?
It took almost 4 years. It took 3 years of going through the publication review board that the CIA has, and it's a pretty intensive process. And have to submit the manuscript, and then go over it line by line and looking for areas where they can say, "Well, you can say that." No, you can't say that. And then you can change this. And I think I was in the 1,000. Redaction mark by the time my book came out.
Wow.
It was a long haul.
Well, again, the name of the book is Guardian, Life in the Crosshairs of CIA's War on Terror. I'm glad this finally got out, Thomas. I did really enjoy reading it. It's more of a novel form, it's in the form of a novel, I guess, is the way you present the stories, and it's very enjoyable. Now, and I want to get into some of it, and I trust, sir, that you'll tell me, because Ben always asks a few dumb questions. You'll say if there's some, you know, if I start to color outside the lines or not. But enlighten me on the path from working in a JCPenney warehouse to the CIA.
After grad school, I was coaching wrestling and working at JCPenney's catalog warehouse, stocking shelves, and I saw an ad in the Milwaukee Journal newspaper for the CIA, which caught my eye, and I thought, wow, okay, I'll apply. And months went by, and didn't hear anything. And then I got a phone call, and it was a recruiter. But I at first thought it was one of my friends playing a prank on me, so I didn't take him seriously at first. But I eventually went and met him, had an initial interview, and then I went. They flew me out to Washington, where it was a very in-depth interview with tests on writing skills, intelligence test, and then, of course, the security vetting, including a polygraph.
You wanted to go into federal service at some level anyway, correct?
Yes. I always had an interest in kind of the adventurous stuff, and I thought about the DEA and then possibly the FBI, but this came up. And it actually it fit my personality very, very well. I went in as a security officer in a career track as a security investigator at first. And then in the career track, you get a chance to move into different job types, everything from physical security to personnel security to and something that I ended up doing most of my career, which is in the protective side.
Thomas, I tell you, you kind of spoiled something for me. I guess I was expecting something a little more intriguing than the CIA just taking out ads in local papers. Did the ad actually say Central Intelligence Agency?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is 1988, and I guess that back then they were looking for some people, and they found that, you know, that was a good way to do it, especially in the Midwest. Someone ended up heading out to Washington, D.C., and I hubbed out of there for quite a few years, more than two decades.
Now, most of your book deals with your role when you were working in the protective operations cadre. And there was a specific reason. I think you were part of the first class of that group, weren't you? And tell us why that special unit was established. There's some background that you touch on already at the start of your book, Guardian.
There was a threat and an eventual catastrophe in the Philippines back in late 80s when Colonel Nick Rowe, who was a military advisor to the Philippine government, was assassinated by a terrorist group. And that threat also spilled over onto some of our personnel. And so CIA sent a team out to protect him. But at the time, we weren't prepared. So back in 1991, they set up the first training class for an overseas protective unit, which they named the Protective Operations Cadre. Now, all this information in the book that I'm telling you about was not known really until the Benghazi incident. And this is the prequel to the Benghazi story, the 13-hour story. And I was able to get into the first training class, and then 1993, I deployed to Somalia, and that was my first real big adventure in the protective world in a war zone, and it was pretty dramatic, and it set the tone for the rest of my career.
Well, let's talk about that, if you don't mind, Thomas. And it, you know, when you get off the plane and you're in the car, you just arrived in Mogadishu, and you mentioned there was a guy, one of the other fellow operators who was rotating out, was 25 years old, but he carried himself like someone twice his age. Should that have been maybe a preview of what you were in for?
Oh, yes. It was the introduction to Mad Max. I mean, it was a real, between the heat and the smell of diesel fuel and jet fuel on the tarmac, to the background of gunfire in the evenings, It was definitely a setup for an adventure, and it proved to be quite a scary place to be. And I ended up being there up until just before the Black Hawk Down incident. We knew things were getting bad.
Well, and you coined Mad Max, and it truly was that way. I mean, between the technicals and just the fact that there was, for all practical purposes, it was anarchy. There was no government. There were no institutions other than the bad guys, right?
That's correct. The warlords basically ruled supreme until the U.S. military moved in. But the areas where we weren't, they still ruled and with an iron fist and a loaded machine gun, and they made it very difficult for us. In fact, one of the worst, Mohammed Farid Hadid, he at one point put a bounty on my team's head. He had physical descriptions of three of us. He had vehicle makes and models, and he was very active in trying to assassinate us while we were moving around doing our protective operations activities, supporting the U.S. military.
And Thomas, I want to talk about your baptism of fire there after we take our first break here, but just briefly describe for our listeners what your role and the role of your team was there in Mogadishu. You weren't spying. You were protecting.
We were protecting the spies, you could say. Our operators, our officers who were out collecting intelligence in support of the military's operations to establish order and to actually get Farah Hadid. And so we would move in motorcades using stealth. So we would low profile. Everything was anything to not attract attention. and we move with speed and surprise. So we would be in areas with no warning. We'd be zipping through the streets, and they wouldn't see us again. We wouldn't take the same routes over and over.
Well, and that's going to come up with another episode I want to talk about of a you touch on in your book, almost a classic of how not to do it with, unfortunately, bad consequences. But you're regularly scouting routes, and it's not like, you know, I know my hometown pretty well, and I know, you know, when there's construction or something. But in Mogadishu, that's almost changing on a daily basis, right? I mean, you got to have yeah. eyes out all the time.
Absolutely. Things change in no time. People move into an area, set up a fake roadblock or an actual ambush site. The road conditions were horrible. If you can imagine, there's nobody fixing the streets. The potholes got to be very bad, and there'd be lots of animals moving around unchecked, and not to mention the traffic. There was no traffic lights. So you're dodging people and animals and ambushes.
Well, and also one thing you share is kind of a bizarre story. Apparently the children there living in a war zone enjoyed a kind of their own little version of chicken, huh?
Yes. We'd be on long roads on the outskirts of town moving at a high rate of speed, and we'd see a child up ahead, and they would watch us, and then just before we came up on them, they would scoot across the road, and they'd be laughing because they made it, and it was their game of chicken.
Wow, folks, this is your host Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Thomas Pecora. He's a retired CIA agent. He's got a new book out called Guardian: Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror. It wasn't long in Mogadishu before Thomas got his first baptism of fire. We're going to share that story with you when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, it's your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very pleased to be joined by Thomas Pecora. Thomas spent 25 years as an operator in the CIA. He's got a great new book out called Guardian: Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror. Thomas, before we get into your baptism of fire, I want to, I think, and you know, what do I know? I'm just a guy that hosts a radio show, but I think there should be an I Told You So medal. Because there's a common theme that runs throughout your book. You mentioned Nick Rowe, yes. Benghazi. You're posting in the Philippines when the senior RSO didn't put additional security measures in place after 9/11. Hello.
Yes.
This disconnect between the warnings from the people on the scene and the rest of the command. At the close of your book, you offer some advice for others that I really liked. One of the particular bullet points was to solve organizational problems and issues at the lowest level. Expound on that a little bit and why you learned that lesson.
Well, at the ground level, you get a lot of the truth. You're seeing what's really going on. It's not being filtered through a variety of papers or through a political bias. You're dealing with what's going on right now, and you have to be able to look at your environment and work on the real threats that you're facing. And in a lot of cases, that those threat warnings, they by the time they filter back to the headquarters element, they diluted. And one of the things that we found was gathering data from every source that we could at the ground level. I mean, I would work with the lowest ranked corporals working out at the edge of the green zone in Iraq, because they were living next door to the Iraqis. They knew what was going on, the ground truth, and that kind of information is at some instances a life and death type of nugget that you can use to protect yourself, protect your unit.
Well, and I want to mention that now because to some extent, in your first experience, I call it your baptism of fire there in Mogadishu, they wanted to go somewhere and you're like, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. Not this way, not now. So walk us through September 5th, 1993, if you would, Thomas.
Yes, we were. We had just received a bit of information about one of the routes that we were using going up to North Mogadishu, where we had a variety of assets that we were meeting to get information. And it turned out that Adid had figured out one of our routes, and he had mined it. He had put some command in his mines in some of the potholes. So we were no longer going to be able to use that route, and we were stuck with only one route up to North Moog. And that means going up and back on the same road. So we were looking to do some more route reconnaissance. But unfortunately, our boss decided that he needed to make a move up to North Moog to meet an asset. And we told him that at this time, this was really risky business. To take the same route up and back was extremely dangerous. So he insisted, so we ended up having to take a different route that we actually had never taken before. We did an overflight with a Black Hawk helicopter the day before. The problem with the route is if we got off the main road, there were no maps of that area. And this is a problem that the Black Hawk Down troops found out when they were caught in an ambush and they got off their main drag. They couldn't find their way back. So it was a very dangerous place to be. And we ended up having to make the move because he insisted. And unfortunately, we ran into the remnants of an ambush that had been staged on a Nigerian outpost. And we drove right into the tail end of that ambush. And luckily, we were able to recognize the threat right at the last second, pull an immediate U-turn, and skedaddle out of the area. But unfortunately, we didn't move fast enough. It's hard to outrun a bullet.
Yeah.
And, we took quite a few rounds, and unfortunately, our protectee in the back was struck in the neck.
And this is the, apparently at that time there was only one armored vehicle in the region, but you couldn't use it because the bad guys knew, you call it the white whale. I mean, that was pretty easy to spot. So you're driving, for all practical purposes, just a standard, what, Isuzu?
It was an Isuzu Trooper, a very small SUV. We had done some custom armoring in a way. We got some metal plates from a helicopter and put them in the doors. But it was no way, in any way, a really armored vehicle. And we were utilizing a very unique follow vehicle, a pickup truck, which didn't take any rounds during the ambush because we found out later it was similar to a vehicle that Adid's people were using. So I think they didn't shoot at it because they didn't want to hit one of their own.
Well, and so you had Mad Maxed up your vehicle as best you could yourself, but you had mentioned that your boss took a round in the neck, and I mean, I can't imagine. I'm trying to get the mental picture as you're describing this in your book. And, I mean, people are shooting at you. You're driving at breakneck speed. You've got a guy in the back seat, or I guess he was in the back seat, bleeding out. Wow. That's a baptism of fire.
Yeah. There's a saying. They say if you see the elephant, that means that you've experienced a life-threatening event. That was for us a pretty dramatic moment. It was also a watershed moment for the unit because it was the first time we really had taken fire, and we made some changes after that, and we were continuously adjusting our operating procedures as we learned more and more about operating these war zones.
And now, Thomas, I don't want to give too much away because I want folks to buy and read the book, but how did you got back? Okay, right? Everything eventually.
Yep. Yeah, we got him back. He survived. He was pretty much bled out by that time. But the doctors, the U.S. military doctors, were outstanding, and they saved his life. And he was later awarded a medal in the director's conference room, and we were able to go and actually be there with him.
Wow. Powerful stuff. One of the things I learned from your book, and it gives a civilian, you'd think that, like when you're playing tag, and I can't remember what you call it, but there's a safe area where you can go where you're okay, that they can't touch you. I assumed up to this point that some of these checkpoints, particularly where you've got, the UN and everybody else present, would be a safe area, but that's not necessarily the case, correct?
No. Sometimes you come across a checkpoint area that it looks like a real one and it's not. Or you come across a unit that really is not interested in doing their job. They're just there to collect their money. And in this case, the Italians were at a checkpoint, and they really weren't interested in providing any aid. They just were hunkered down and going to bide their time.
I've got no words for that. So you, and correct me on the timeline, because we had we just had an Air Force Special Operations, a Special Forces guest on the show, who had come home about a month prior to the Battle of Mogadishu took place, and he said that, you know, he's sitting here at home watching this on the news, and he if he could teleport back there, he would have done it to go back and support the folks. If I get this correctly, Thomas, you departed Mogadishu a mere 10 days before the Battle of Mogadishu, the Black Hawk Down incident. What was going through your mind when you were stateside watching that happen?
Horror at the circumstances. The frustration of knowing the dangerous situation they were in, and how they were not given the elements that they needed to do the job. They had been told they'd asked for armor, and they were turned down by the Secretary of Defense, and that later resulted in his being fired.
And that comes back to what we were talking about before. You know, the I told you so medal, I guess.
Yes.
Well, he didn't get a medal. He got an introduction to the private sector.
Yes.
Before we take our next break, one of the you also reference, and I use the quotation fingers, your experience in a certain African country, which was somewhat of a watershed moment for you. And throughout your entire career, we see innocence caught between, you know, ruthless terrorists on one end, and a government that is either just so corrupt it can't help, or the means that they have to use to respond to the ruthless terrorists are ruthless in and of themselves. That had to start weighing on you after just a couple years, Thomas, much less 25.
Actually, seeing what they had to go through and the life they led, because these elements, these bad guys, were truly using the terror in terrorism. They would slit the throats of they'd go creep into a village and slit everybody's throats, and next day everybody'd be dead. And just the people trying to survive that type of situation, and then the as you pointed out, the reaction by the government, they had no choice but to fight fire with fire. So their actions were very heavy-handed. It was the only way to back this terrorist group down. And eventually they actually took control of their city and were able to push them out. But it took many years and a lot of casualties.
Well, and Thomas, that's why I chose to introduce the show with quotes from your book talking about how we just don't realize so often, or we take for granted, how good we have it here in the United States and how grateful and cognizant we need to be that there's folks like you that are standing on the wall. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with Thomas Pecora. He's the author of Guardian, Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror, 25 years with the CIA. Stick around. We'll be back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. In his 25 years with the CIA, Thomas Pecora saw a lot of things. He summarizes some of those and talks about some of those experiences in his new book called Guardian, Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror. Thomas, this is not a political talk show, but I'm going to make you king for a day. You spent a lot of time, you know, in the Philippines and those areas as well, which, if people in America and the U.S. aren't paying attention, they don't think, when they think about terrorism, they think about the Middle East. They don't think so much about, you know, Southeast Asia and some of those places. But there was one particular situation with some, I think the Burnhams, the tourists.
Burnhams, yes.
who were kidnapped by some bad guys there, and I use the quotation fingers, the rescue didn't go so well. You spent a lot of your time training others who were going to go into the line of fire. Do you, again, if you're a king for a day, I know we can't just drop our teams into other countries when we want to, or maybe you can, I don't know, it is a CIA, but sometimes the locals, as well-intentioned as they are, they just don't have the capability, right? I mean, that's a reality you have to deal with.
That's correct. Yeah. During my career, I did a lot of teaching. I actually, for 3 years, I was training foreign presidential protection details. And so I got a chance to see the capabilities of a lot of countries, and a lot of them don't have the resources we do. The U.S. government gets involved in assisting quite a few different countries with not only their protection details, but also with their military and their police elements. But sometimes they're facing threats that are just beyond their capability. And then in the Philippines, that was one case where the bad guys were connecting with Al-Qaeda. They were working with another terrorist group out of Indonesia called the Jamia Islamiyah. And this is one of the things the book kind of covers, is the war on terror and how it may be happening all the way over in Southeast Asia, but it does affect us remotely in terms of the American population that lives in those areas, and also the potential threat that these terrorist groups are going to spread. And so fighting that and keeping that out of our back door is one of the major things that major missions that the CIA and other U.S. government elements have been doing.
Well, and I'm so glad, because it's not my phrase, but I love it. You know, we always wanted to be an away game. And I got to tell you, though, I consider myself pretty well informed, but specifically pages 302 and 303 of your book, I wrote it down, because you start to rattle off this list of terrorist attacks, one after another after another. And I don't know if they never made the news, or most of us have never heard of it, but I'm just sitting there in my chair aghast, because this stuff, I had no idea, Thomas, that this was happening on such a regular basis. Am I just that peacefully naive?
No, the advantage is that you can live in America and not be affected by this. But if you're a specialist in this area, and you have to be aware of what's going on and the patterns. For example, looking back and writing my book, I realized that I was fighting against bin Laden and his elements for most of my career, starting with he sent guys into Somalia to help them fight against the U.S. troops in Black Hawk Down. Later on, when I was working in Khartoum, I was working directly against his elements. And then in the Philippines, the Busayep group that were the kidnappers of the Burnhams, they had direct affiliation with Al-Qaeda. And then later on, another terrorist that we captured, he was the number one Al-Qaeda affiliate in all of Asia. And he had planned attacks on the Singapore, the U.S. Embassy in Singapore, and the U.S. Embassy in Manila. So there was a theme there, it appeared, looking back, where these terrorists, they have effect all over the world. And as you put it very well, we want to keep it an away game. We want them, we're going to fight them where they are, not where they want to be.
Thomas, from where you are now, based on your experience looking around the globe with a special set of lenses that most of us don't have, how do you think we're doing? Are we winning? Is this a stalemate? Are we losing?
Well, we've won some and we've lost some. We've lost some stability in the Middle East. Egypt is teetering. Yemen is around the bend, just like, and as well as Libya. When we had our allies there, Gaddafi was kind of keeping things in check. Mm-hmm. But now he's gone, and these countries, when they're unstable, that's when ISIL and Al Qaeda and other splinter groups come in. And they take advantage of the lack of oversight, the lack of security. And that's a serious problem for us.
You mentioned Libya. I want to talk a little bit about, again, coming back, in your chapter about Iraq and your time in the Green Zone, which, I mean, that alone could have been two or three books themselves, Thomas. But I learned something. You mentioned that the ambassador in a country, in a foreign country, his role and basically the authority that he has there. I mean, he is the direct voice of the president, the hand, if I can borrow from a recent HBO series. But sometimes you have to work around that. And, you know, Benghazi, that makes me think about coming back to the way we started the show, is sometimes folks, you know, higher up the chain aren't listening. But tell us the story about the big fish and the worm in during your time in the Green Zone.
we knew that there was a bomb maker who liked to watch his work, and he would he specifically decided to target the ambassador in Baghdad, and we had elements that were focused on his activities. I can't go into more detail than that on that. But I had a good, really good relationship with the ARSO, the State Department Diplomatic Security Officer, who was specifically in charge of the ambassador's protection detail. And we got to be very good friends. And also we had set up our own communication system. Basically, I would on a moment's notice, I could call him on the cell phone and warn him about something that was very time sensitive. And I found out that that the worm was out, and he specifically was going for the big fish. He was, and at that point, I had some inkling that the ambassador was going to make a move out into the red zone, into the danger area. So I immediately called my friend on his phone, and he answered. He was putting the ambassador and General Casey, who was the head of all U.S. troops in Iraq, into the limo, and they were about to go out into the danger zone. And I told him, you know, that the worm was out and that they were in danger. And he made the command decision to stop the movement. And the ambassador looked at him and basically said, "If you're wrong about this, you're fired." And we investigated. The ARSO sent people out, and they found out that there indeed was a bomb placed in the road that they were going to use. And there was also some bad guys nearby with a camera ready to film the ambush.
Yeah, that would have been some good propaganda from their perspective.
Yes.
So in the movies, thank goodness the ambassador actually listened and trusted the folks that, while lower ranking perhaps, knew their business. I guess it doesn't always turn out that way, though, does it? I mean, we see in movies all the time, Thomas, where the Secret Service agent or the CIA agent says, "No, I'm overriding your authority," and everybody gets angry and it works out. But
no, it doesn't always work that way, unfortunately. And sometimes people get hurt. But part of what we can do to prevent that is working with all our resources and establishing relationships. Trust, like my relationship with the ARSO in that specific circumstance, he felt comfortable enough to make that decision based on our relationship. And that's working at the lowest levels and keeping the information flowing between the units that really need it.
I found it interesting. It kind of made me smile a little bit, I guess, in sort of a bizarre way. You talk about a place called the Babylon Bar. And I almost got this image in my mind of that bar in the first Star Wars movie where you've got all these different characters. And how much work goes on in those kinds of places?
Oh, lots of work. I ran as part of my duties as the head of security for all of our operations in Iraq, on our compound in the Green Zone, we had a bar. And the CIA is wet everywhere we go. We have alcohol. And it's in certain areas, we may be the only ones, and that's an awesome currency. And it's a great way to invite people over and begin relationships and gather data. And we would have all kinds of different types of people coming in to enjoy the bar. And meanwhile, we'd be getting a lot of work done. I was able to get things done with contractors and make relationships with people in the State Department and also military elements.
And I tell you, Thomas, the reason I appreciate that is it kind of took me back in my own professional life. Early on in my career as a lobbyist, my boss insisted I leave the office and go to a spring training game. And I wanted to impress him. I was like, no, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to do work. He basically ordered me to go to that ball game. I got more work done at that baseball game because all the people, you know, all the honchos were there enjoying the baseball game. So it turned out pretty okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by Thomas Pecora, 25 years with the CIA. When we come back, Thomas, I want to talk about that little situation with the private security company. I think it was Operation Apollo, where it's best sometime to learn from others' mistakes, we can get into that when we come back. Stick around, folks. It's your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back with you. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very pleased to be joined by Thomas Pecora. Thomas has 25 years, or had 25 years of experience in the CIA. He's got a great book out called Guardian: Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror. Thomas, this, I guess, I don't want to say the show's taken somewhat a somber turn, but this is serious business. Mm-hmm. Want to do some kind of rapid fire, pick your brain as we wrap up the show, but I really, you don't, and for the plumbers and the fake cable repair guys sitting outside the station right now who are listening in, I want to be very clear, you didn't share that much trade craft in your book, but there were some, for someone who's relatively bright, could you know, get some items about, you know, driving and routes and things you do and you don't do. In particular, I it kind of broke my heart, but reading about that situation where I think it was a private security company in Iraq, Operation Apollo, maybe if you could share with our listeners what went wrong and what didn't get done right there.
Yes, that was a tragic event involving what their famous, they called the Edinburgh Risk Team, and they were ambushed on Route Irish, one of the most dangerous routes during the Iraqi conflict, and basically in the span of 32 seconds, the four of their operators were hit, and three eventually died. They were moving in a low-profile protection mode, which means that they were trying to draw on no attention to themselves. They were just trying to look like a couple of sedans moving along the road. Unfortunately, they got stuck in traffic, and they made a few critical errors in terms of their procedures. They didn't keep the cars in a mobile stage. One of the drivers actually put the car in park. They didn't move when they needed to in terms of maintaining a low profile with the rest of the traffic. They ended up being away from some of the traffic, so they stood out. And they weren't quite aware of their surroundings enough to notice that there was some bad guys moving in a vehicle paralleling them on a side road. And that vehicle was able to lay down a significant amount of fully automatic rifle fire into their vehicles with armor-piercing rounds. So the tragedy is low-profile protection only works when you're in low profile and they don't see you. But once they see you, if you're not mobile, if you're not able to get out of there, you're not going to have the firepower or the armor to stop the kinds of attacks that these bad guys are able to inflict on you. And this was a learning lesson for a lot of different low profile protection outfits. We pretty much mastered our ability to move like this. And to give you an idea, we've been doing this since basically 1990, and we have we've never lost a protectee, and we've only had really one officer killed in all these years. And we worked all the major conflicts. And anybody who's worked the war zones know there is an element of luck, but over that length of time, it's not luck. It's adapting, continuously adapting to your environment, and keeping strictly to the theory, which is if they can't see you, they can't attack you.
Bingo. And I tell you, that's something, definitely one of the learning lessons I took from your book was the idea of it's best not to be seen. And if you are seen, unlike the movies, you don't go all Rambo. You get the heck out of Dodge as quick as you can. I assume you, part of the planning is you should be looking for those escape routes all the time.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's like a pilot was always looking for a place to land a plane.
Good example. Well, let's talk a little bit. In fact, one other quote was struck me that when from your book, when we miscalculate the enemy's intimate knowledge of his terrain, his experience in the battle space, and his will to fight, we lose lives. I wanted to emphasize that because I think all too often from the safety here of the U.S., we all too often underestimate our enemies, and they're always adapting. And I would guess in your line of work, that was always a challenge as well, wasn't it, Thomas?
Absolutely. You've got to constantly be aware of what they're doing, how they're changing. In Iraq, for example, they started out with simple small arms fire. And when they realized that they couldn't beat our armor, they started adding roadside bombs. And when we cleared the roadsides, they started putting bombs in cars. So there's a continuous change. And they the will to fight, the Somalis were nowhere near a match for our troops, but under the conditions that the Black Hawk troops found themselves that day, the bad guy was able to capitalize on their knowledge of the terrain and our inability to navigate our way out of their neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. So two quick questions. One, what was the coolest job you ever had during your time in the CIA? And two, what was the most dangerous place to be posted, the place you just plain old didn't want to go?
The most fun I had were the 3 years when I was trained in presidential protection details, because they would be smiling when we arrived and crying when we left, because we were providing them with training that they had never, in most cases, never had. It was a very positive experience. I made a lot of friends. I learned a lot about how other countries operate, and I got a chance to travel to some nicer places. On the other side, in terms of the scariest, Somalia was one of the worst, but actually Khartoum was even scarier. I was posted there doing counterterrorism surveillance work. We were working against the bad guys, and all the bad guys were in Khartoum. Everybody from bin Laden and he wasn't even the big guy then. We had Abu Nidal, we had Carlos the Jackal, we had Hamas, Hezbollah, you name them, they were all there. And this is where they would go for R&R. This is their safe zone. So they would be moving around doing whatever they wanted, and they would see us moving to and from our offices and doing things. And they sometimes would get bored and they'd start to run attack scenarios against us. But only in the sense of they were rehearsing. But you don't know when they're going to decide, oh, this is a good day to actually pull it off. So I would end up in situations where the cars would come up on us, and I don't know whether we were going to get hit or not. And it happened so frequently over that period that it was a pretty rough tour.
Thomas, I've only got about 2 minutes, 1.5 minutes left, but I want to just get your thoughts on another quote from your book. And you say, the tough part is coming to grips with the fact that there are mental dangers as well as physical ones, and that there's always a payment plan. We just don't know what the currency will be paying in. For your counterparts, first responders, other people who are in a very stressful job like yours, just kind of your quick advice on how do they deal with that. What's the best thing to do?
Understanding what you're getting into, truly realizing that these are life-threatening situations. We used to have a thing called danger pay, and different government agencies use different terms for that. But when you hear that, you should know that you're going to be in danger, and there is a good chance that something could go wrong and you could get hurt. If you walk into those situations thinking that you're not, and it's not really a possibility, if something goes bad, it has a much more dramatic mental cost. So I used to do a lot of preparatory work for people going to the war zones, trying to get them prepared so that they were, so that things did go bad, they were out of the denial stage and they were ready to go. The other part is understanding that these things are going to take a toll and that you have to be ready to react to that. And that means getting help if you need it, talking to people, going to see specialists. Post-traumatic stress disorder has affected so many people. And in certain lines of work, it's much more prevalent.
Wonderful.
You need to bring that to the forefront.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for that. Again, folks, the book is Guardian, Life in the Crosshairs of the CIA's War on Terror. Thomas, thank you for spending some time with us here on American Warrior Radio this weekend. You can find this podcast and over 210 others, AmericanWarriorRadio.com, Facebook, American Warrior Radio. We even have a Twitter page at Warrior Radio TUC. Check out Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.